Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Robert Mackey from The Intercept will join us to discuss why Donald Trump's victory lap in regard to the coronavirus is all based on creative accounting coming out of the White House. And Supreme Court of the United States expert Scott Lemieux will run down some important cases in front of the high court at a time when people's attention may be, obviously, somewhere else. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor. Support the show. You can help out by becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com. Check it out right now. ROFpodcast.com. Here to start off the show, the news of the week, Heather Digby Parton from Hullabaloo. So, Heather, another week. Here we are, still inside, more or less, not heading into work. However, many places around the country are beginning to open up in one fashion or another. That, you know, that means different things in different places. But what is clear, I mean, there's two things that are clear. One is that it's not sustainable to have everybody quarantining in the way that we have been for the first, month, 6 weeks, 2 months. That is long-term, it's not sustainable. What is also clear is that how you change from that is there's a wide range of possibilities. And I would say that, we used to say when I was an actor, as an actor, they tell you, make a choice. Just be conscious of what you're doing in that moment. Make a choice. And, people could disagree with your choices as to how you decided to play with something. But the important thing is that you made a choice. Well, in this instance, it feels like there's no choice that has been made. It's just like whatever and no forethought whatsoever. And it's not only just a carelessness. It feels like, and I know you've written about this, but it feels like it's a concerted effort to make really no effort to mitigate this disease whatsoever by the Trump administration.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt at this point. We've sort of seen this from the beginning. Trump, there's been an amazing amount of inside reporting of how the administration has been responding to the crisis. And it's kind of like James Fallows from The Atlantic actually put it this way, said it's like the Pentagon Papers are being revealed in real time. And I think that's actually true because we're seeing exactly how this has unfolded within the government response. And it's really startling because we know that they lived in denial and then they started dithering. And, then we put Jared Kushner in charge and we'll have to talk about that at some point of a bunch of the responses. And what seems to be clear that coming into focus now is that the Trump administration just simply can't do the job that they just are incapable of it. It's just not possible. They can't get that job done, which is the job that would have been that we were buying time for the government to do. When they closed down, as you say, no one ever expected you'd close down for forever until the vaccine came online, whenever that was. I mean, that was never the thing. What they wanted to do was flatten the curve to allow for the hospitals and the medical community to be able to handle whatever surge there was. But that wasn't the only thing. The other thing was to keep people at home as much as possible, just reduce everything to the most essential parts of the economy, put everything kind of in an induced coma for a while, just keep the vital organs running, right, so that the government could get in place the things that could make a reopening of the economy safe. for employers, for customers, for employees, for everyone. And, you know, we all knew that that was not going to be a perfect system, but they could do a lot to mitigate it with a testing regime, with contact tracing, with, you know, working maybe on treatments. I mean, there were a whole lot, learning more about the disease. All of this was just an attempt to buy some time to get everything in order. And we had time. We knew from January on that this thing was happening. We knew that it was coming to this country. People with pandemic experience were screaming at the top of their lungs. We just had a whistleblower this week from the government, this guy, Dr. Bright from BARDA,
right,
who had, you know, he provided more evidence that they were warning everybody that this thing was coming down. And, of course, the government, instead of taking it from that moment, as other countries have done, and other countries have had their response has been much, much better, taking that time that was allowed to get in place these things that you could safely open the economy and get back, they didn't do any of that. And I think what we realize now is that they just can't do it. They are incapable of doing it because the leadership at the very top is what it is. It is Donald Trump who is incapable of being a president. Combined with, you know, this kind of toxic ideology from the right, this anti-government idea, their twisted view of federalism, which, you know, is completely bizarre in this particular moment. And so what's happened now, we finally got to a point where that literally keeping the economy closed as it was is no longer feasible for, you know, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which are these long lines of people going to food banks because they can't get enough food for their family. People need to be able to, you know, get money in order to survive, which we always knew was going to happen. And of course, the government could have stepped in and done a lot more on that count as well. They could have opened up the SNAP program. They could have done a lot of things to make it so that people did not, you know, have to wait in line for 4 hours to get some groceries for their children. But, you know, here we are, and basically the Trump administration has washed its hands of the coronavirus. They have now decided to declare mission accomplished. We've done everything that we can do. There's nothing more. We're just going to go out. We're going to, whatever you guys decide is fine with us. Trump is going back to his primary job, which in his view is running for re-election, which he's been doing since the day he was inaugurated in 2017. So, you know, here we are. It's over as far as I can tell, as far as the federal response is concerned. It's done. And so this chaotic situation with states opening in various ways and people, you know, should I go back to work, and people in meatpacking plants and prisons and all these places where everybody's coming down with, even to the extent that there's people in the White House who are still coming down with it. The president's valet was tested
right,
positive. Here we are, and there's absolutely, I don't, you know, I am beyond words now at this point on what is going to happen. Honestly, I do not know, but I can tell you it does not look good because it seems as though they've thrown up their hands, and all we can hope for is that the governor or the mayor, wherever we live, isn't completely insane and somehow our neighbors and coworkers and friends are, you know, take all the guidance to heart that they know about. And then I guess it's just, you know, Russian roulette or hide in your basement. I mean, this is where we're at as America. It's pathetic, and virtually nobody except for Russia is doing the same thing around the world. I mean, here we are, the most advanced, technologically advanced country in the world, and we might as well be some third world African nation, as far as I can tell.
And we should be clear. I mean, I think, you know, let's try and, because I think your assessment of what they're doing is absolutely, I mean, it's correct. It's verifiable. It's, you know, it's obvious. The question
is the CDC guidelines, right? I mean, they threw the new CDC guidelines in the trash. So that tells you a lot.
There was literally a full, you know, a fully, I think, formed, basically operation manual, if you will, for how you ease out. Now, first of all, there are guidelines that the government had set, I don't know, several weeks ago that would make that states were to use to assess as to whether they were ready to get to leave, right? I mean, to, you know, to ease the quarantining, more or less. And that was, you know, have you had 7 days of continuous decreases in your number of deaths, in your number of hospitalizations? The majority of the states that are, you know, opening up, as it were, have not met those guidelines. You know, it's basically like, you know, anybody, it's not hard to come up with an analogy. You make a plan and then you just don't follow it, is basically what they're doing. And, you know, the agenda is pretty clear here, right? I mean, there's only two ways out of this. At the end of all of it, there's another way in which you manage it, but their theory is we need to get to herd immunity. That means 60 to 70% of the population needs to get it. And, you know, once we get there, what happens is the virus's ability to spread diminishes, because right now, if I get it, I have a R naught. It's an actually like R zero, but it's a British term apparently. So an R naught of one to two of around like two people, or, you know, 1.14 or something like that. And the idea is that the virus is going to replicate itself by traveling to other hosts in a number greater than one. If we get down to an R naught of less than one, the virus ultimately peters out. It does not have enough hosts in which it can replicate itself, and it peters out. The theory is that if 60 to 70% of the population gets it, they will have antibodies that make it impossible for them to get it going forward. That will make it very, very difficult for the virus to travel, essentially. And then it will slowly die, and then it will die. And then we're all back to normal again. The problem with this, of course, is the reason why we didn't do it the first time is because, like you say, if we just do this willy-nilly, we're going to overwhelm each locality's medical capacity. We're just going to have too many patients for the hospitals. And we managed to flatten that curve, but it's not like we can't. I mean, if we start acting like it's March 7th again in the country, or March 1st, really, or, you know, late February, we're going to be right back in this position we are now with the same, maybe more deaths, right? Because in those dates I just mentioned, late February, early March, it wasn't as prevalent as it is around the country today. That's just the reality of it. And so if we behave like we did in late February, a lot more people are going to get sick than did last time, because the virus is already more dispersed around the country, and it will be, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 weeks before we see the lagging indicator of hospitalizations and deaths. And I think the Trump administration has made this calculus that we're going to be able to get to herd immunity without, this is the Trump administration, we're going to get to herd immunity without paying too exorbitant a political price. That it is going to be predominantly a lower income disease. It is going to be a predominantly black and brown disease. And I think the Trump administration, I think they're saying, and it's going to be a predominantly blue state disease because of issues like density. And I think they're just saying, like, we're going to roll the dice. We'll let it roll. And, you know, 60% of the country, 70% of the country gets infected. If we're anywhere from 5% to 10% right now, nationally speaking, well, do the math. The best case scenario is we need to multiply that death rate by 10 to 20, right? And that's how many people are going to die at the end of this if we pursue this policy. You know, you're looking at anywhere from 700,000 to 1.5 million people will die if we just go forward with this without any type of like mitigation technology, mitigation medicine, vaccination, whatever developed at this point. And it could very well get very, very, very ugly.
Well, you know, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine how anyone thinks that that's a politically useful calculation. I mean, to me, that just seems absurd. But apparently, they're under the impression, I think, that, as you put it, you know, most of the people who die will be, you know, I mean, there's a lot of elderly people. It's a preponderance of, you know, people over the age of 70 that are dying so far. And that it's black and brown people, you know, workers, immigrants, you know, the kind of people that Trump, of course, personally doesn't care about, and neither do his voters. So I think they think that they can get away with that. But you know, this isn't true. It's now become a cliche that the virus doesn't, you know, is nonpartisan. You know, the virus doesn't really care. And it is true that, you know, more wealthier people can probably get better health care. I think we know that, and that there are, maybe they'll get treatments that other people won't. But nonetheless, you know, this you get 5 million people dead, and that's a pretty startling, you know, shocking number, especially, you know, for the United States. I mean, I don't think it's really sunk into people just how badly the U.S. is handling this compared to other countries. For whatever reason, you know, this hasn't really sunk in. And I'm not just talking about the Fox News audience. I'm talking about everybody that, you know, if you look at the way that other countries have handled this, you can see how it could have been done efficiently in a way that really did minimize the caseload and the deaths. They could have, it was possible to do it. And of course it's hard, you know, we're a big country and with all this, you know, the federalist system that we have, there are reasons that it's a challenge. But it didn't have to be like this. It really didn't. And I think that's going to become clear. So I can't see how the politics really work for them, but I think it's really, Sam, they just can't do anything else. It has become clear that they don't have the capability. It's just beyond their ability to do the things that you would expect any normal administration to do. And I mean any administration. I don't care what other president it was. Any of them, no matter how ideologically, rigidly right-wing or whatever, would have been better at mobilizing the federal government to do what needed to be done to prepare the entire country to reopen. And you know, people like to pretend, oh, well, you know, this region, they're fine, and this one's doing better, and that one's doing worse. And it's, you know, they keep thinking that somehow or another these are discrete places. We, you know, we're interconnected. You know, we talk about this, you know, how the supply chain is global and that's a problem, et cetera. Well, what the hell do they think the supply chain is in the United States? I mean, this is the entire country is economically intertwined in ways that can't, you know, we can't extricate ourselves from it. It's completely impossible. And in fact, you know, we're talking about now, we're seeing that you know, people in Georgia, for instance, they reopened first, right? Brian Kemp, that psycho down there, reopened his state, and now they're having outbreaks all over the place. But when they reopened restaurants, people came from states all over the place, crossed the borders to come in and have dinner and, you know, breathe the air of a bunch of spreaders, and then took it back home. I mean, that's just some small example, right, of how our country is. And, you know, now we're seeing people blame New York for, you know, well, it's their fault because people were flying from New York with the disease around the country. Well, this is the United States. I mean, we're not you know, we're not discrete states, not really. I mean, not since the Articles of Confederation, anyway. We're a country, and we're intertwined. And so this idea that somehow or another you can do this here and that there, and, oh, we're different in a red state than we are in a blue state, that's nuts. We're not. The virus is hitting everybody in various stages, and it will come back in various stages. And so the complete, you know, abdication of responsibility by the federal government, it's outright inability to do the job. This is a shocking development for America, the America that, you know, planned the Normandy invasion and the trip to the moon and brought people back. I mean, you know, decades ago, we can't do this, or at least Donald Trump's administration can't do it. And, you know, I honestly think that we're heading into a November here where we're going to have to grapple with the fact that we have this massive, massive crisis. And by the way, you know, it might even be rewarded by the American people because people just don't understand what's going on. And I don't know if they really get it or they will. I mean, there's a strong sense of denial I sense, yep, among the American people.
I mean, I think, you know, I think from the Trump administration's perspective, I think they're banking on, like, look, you know, look at the outcry of people, 75,000 people dead. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind that Brad Pasquale, the Trump campaign manager, who was, I can't remember what it was. He was a former video editor, maybe, and maybe
like web designer or something.
Web designer, yeah, or something. Like, he's now the chairman of the Trump reelection. He's a campaign manager. Also now incredibly wealthy. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, how he's running the campaign. Just seems to be a, you know, an embezzlement pot or something like that. But I'm convinced that they have made a calculation that, yes, I agree, they can't do anything else. They don't have any other options. And they, you know, the Trump administration operates like Donald Trump, which is like, you don't lead, and I put that in quotes, you don't, you know, be the head of everything by actually being proficient at things. You be the head of everything by, like, cheerleading, and
exactly,
everything follows. And I think they are of the attitude that, like, look, 75,000 people have died, and there doesn't seem to be a strong contingent of mourners, I guess, you know, for lack of a better word, right? Where, like, there is no, the American public is not responding enough to the deaths that have taken place for this particular leadership of the country to determine that it is not worth their while to have more people die. Like, in other words, like, I think, you know, they're saying, like, I think they're having conversations in the White House that, like, yeah, 400,000 or 500,000 people. If we get above 600,000, we may have a little bit of a problem. But 400,000 or 500,000 people only means that, like, 3 or 5 million people, you know, like, family members, and they're dispersed across the country. And yeah, it's just not, by November, people are not going to care. I think that is, I honestly think that is the calculation. That, you know, by November, the people are going to be forgotten that they had a cousin that died or something. That's just my guess, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's not their theory. It's the only thing that makes sense.
It is. I mean, that's the only thing that makes sense, which is just, look, let's just barrel ahead, you know, keep our heads down. Trump's back out doing campaign events. He went to that mask factory this week, refused to wear a mask, and basically gave a campaign speech and rewarded some people who were nice to him and said he'd buy them lunch, big of him, the billionaire, the alleged billionaire. And, you know, I think he's right back at it. I mean, I think that they are making this calculation that by the time we get to the election, that the acuteness of this will be behind them, and will have just absorbed all of these deaths and, you know, absorbed the illnesses, and this whole story will be something. And, you know, there is some reason to believe, considering the incredible array of scandals and crises in the Trump administration so far, that the attention span of the American public on Trump malfeasance is pretty short. And I think that they have in their minds figure, hey, you know, this is just another one of those things, and the fake news media, you know, they're just, you know, they're just pumping it up, and we'll get beyond this. And especially if they think, you know, well, look, you know, if we bring the unemployment level down and we can get us down to 10%, and then he'll blame, you know, the fake news and blame the Democrats and whatever for it being, and they'll get through it. They, I think they figure, look, we can just get through this, because it's clear that they can't fix it, because they just don't know how. They don't have the actual capability of doing what a normal administration would do. So, you know, here we are. But, I mean, do you think that they're right? I mean, can it be that people will just absorb? I mean, we could have, you know, 500,000 deaths by August if it keeps going at this rate. I mean, this could be.
I think that the majority of Americans can absorb this, can absorb that level of death. I think it is within their nature to do so. And I think that the percentage of those that are Trump voters or potential Trump voters is even, you know, you know, it's
90%.
Well, I'm just saying, like, but they can absorb it. But also the ones that can't, right? Let's say, I don't know, let's say 40% of the country or 60% of the country is just like, this is horrific. This is, as a researcher from Yale called it, a, you know, some type of like genocide by default.
Yeah.
Well, out of that 40%, how many people are going to vote for Trump anyways, I think, is their perspective. And I think that's the calculation they've made. I think that's the calculation they've made. And, you know, they may be right. You know, I think the economy is going to be in worse shape than we're really sort of conscious of at this point. But who knows? Maybe they'll spend enough that it comes back, at least, you know, anemically for a period of time. But they could be right, you know, and let's take this moment to pivot just for a second, since we're on this politics question. The Democratic Party has been passive in this, you know, either deliberately or just, you know, by happenstance. They have been passive. They, you know, they are there. There's criticism of Trump, yes, but it is unclear to me that they have presented a cohesive plan. You know, look, there's no reason why the Democratic Party, and I don't care if it's Biden's campaign or if it's, you know, Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer, they all have the resources to put out a plan not too dissimilar than the CDC plan that was shelved. And they can say, like, here is the plan that we hope people will follow. You know, they could do that. On some level, that's like, I know you're not the president, but our president's a lunatic. And, you know, Speaker of the House, that's not chump change. You're not the crossing guard. You know what I mean? Like, you actually have a position of leadership in the country. Why don't you do the things that he's not doing? And at the very least, and maybe nobody pays attention, but at the very least, what you're doing is you are creating some form of distinction between you and the president. And the distinction ends up being good, bad. And like you can't, you know, they're critiquing, but they're real, you know, the critique is soft. It is not substantive in many respects of the president. And you also need to be critiquing the Republican Party. Like this is what the Democrats seem to be loath to do, and that is to lose a battle. that will, you know, it's one thing to say Trump is just going to fail. But if you lose a battle, at least you have the documentation and the history of having a the plan for another course that could have been followed, which highlights the failure of the Trump administration. And they just seem completely reluctant to engage in that. They're just hoping everybody figures it out on their own. And maybe they will, but maybe they won't. And I mean, I'm very concerned about that, because in many respects, we have been in the same place for the past 6 to 8 weeks, which is the Democrats are, I get the whole concept of, you know, when your opponent is doing themselves harm, you know, step out of the way. I get that. But it's unclear to me that the president is doing himself harm. You know, it's just a poll came out this week from Civics, and it showed Joe Biden less favorable than Donald Trump. Now, Joe Biden was up in a national vote poll by 2 points, you know, and neither one of them was above 50%. But, you know, he's losing to Donald Trump by 4 or 5 points in terms of most likable. Now, it's possible that there's a lot of people there, you know, obviously who would vote for him, but just prefer someone else. But that, you know, this is worrying that there's such passivity by the Democrats, both in terms of like the politics and the policy.
I totally agree. And I think, I mean, I think there's some justification for looking over the last, you know, the last little while, say from February through the end of April, and saying, all right, just let's see what he does. We know that he's, you know, incapable, but we don't want to step on any toes. We're in a crisis. Let's just try and see how this plays out. But we know now. We know now that they are incapable. We know that he's declaring mission accomplished, basically. I mean, he's playing live and let die at his campaign events now. I mean, in fact, Brad Parscale, I just have to get this in, he sent out a tweet calling the campaign the Death Star. I mean, I don't know if that's good or bad. They seem to think that's really a big, you know, winning formula to call themselves the Death Star. But, you know, this is where we're at now.
Did they see Star Wars?
Yeah, I don't know, but he
because
thinks, you know,
the Death Star end well for the Death Star, for either Death Star. They had two of them.
Exactly. But nonetheless, he's proudly, you know, sending that out there. And, you know, so this is where we're in a new phase now. Let me just put it that way. We're in a new phase. We're in phase two of the crisis as far as, you know, the politics of it, I think. And it is now time, you know, Trump's going to declare, he's declaring mission accomplished. This is out of my hands. You governors handle the disease. You know, I'm moving on. We're reopening the economy and everything's going to be great, great, great. And so it's exactly as you say, you know, they can't do anything. So instead it's all hype and PR, yep, and, you know, and BS. So they're going to go out and do this thing. Well, now is the time for the seriousness of saying, okay, you know, we didn't interfere. We let you do your thing because you're the president and we have a crisis and we're trying to just everybody try to work together. You blew that. Now let's look at what is really what we really, really need to do. And, you know, here's the, you know, I know that, you know, Joe Biden is in his basement and he's, you know, adhering to the social distancing guidelines. Well, everywhere around the country is starting to open up a little, including even places like California, which I think has done a good job. You know, I think New York is starting to open up, you know, look at opening up a little. They have to do that, and we understand if they do it smartly and you know, deliberately and strategically, it's possible to do it. So Joe Biden needs to get out, you know, get into a private plane. They can find one that's been sterilized and keeps him out of harm's way. And he needs to go someplace. And he needs to get out there, and he needs to meet up with, I don't know, Gavin Newsom, or meet up with Andrew Cuomo, and sit there and start to look like the alternative and present himself. And I know that there's a risk in that for him. He's an elderly man. He's in the high-risk group, but so is Donald Trump. Right. And he's doing it, too. And this is an essential thing. I mean, he's got to take a little bit of a risk here. You know, Pelosi could do the same thing. And I'm talking about getting out into the country and stopping, you know, that it's time for them, and they can wear masks and do all the, you know, the model the proper behavior. But take charge of it, at least in terms of the alternative to what is happening. While Trump's doing his happy talk, Biden can sit there and talk to some of the epidemiologists and the other politicians like Cuomo and Newsom and Jay Inslee in Washington and others who've done a good job and talk to them about what really needs to be done and how this that whole thing and present an alternative. And I honestly think that the media will jump on that. I think they're hungry for that kind of footage, that kind of images that they can present to their audience, because it's getting old for them too. You've got these Trump events, and then they're sitting, everybody's sitting in their living rooms doing analysis. I mean, it's time to take control of that narrative, and I really hope they do it, because it's getting late, and before too long, Trump's little victory march is going to be the narrative, and everybody else is going to be, sort of following behind, going, oh no, you screwed up, and that's not the way it should be. I mean, they should be right out there right now saying, okay, here's what we need to do now.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, and really, the next 3 or 4 weeks are going to be very difficult. And then, after 4 weeks, they're going to be telling. But, the next 3 or 4 weeks, it's going to be one of those things where it's like, I don't know. The patient has been shot up with a bunch of morphine and steroids. And so they're walking around and they're smiling. But in the meantime, something is eating at them on the inside. And on some level, that's the society that we're going to be looking at for the next 3 or 4 weeks, right? People are going to be going out there. All of the indicators are lagging indicators. So we won't know for a while if people are safe or being able to keep safe. And we're going to be in this holding pattern politically, although I imagine Trump, it will be all in, that this has been a massive success, and we'll hear more about it.
Oh yeah,
relentlessly over the next 4 or 5 weeks. We'll hear about it beyond that, but the next 4 or 5 weeks are going to be the toughest to sort of like say to assess, because we really don't know. And with that, Heather, always a pleasure to try and make sense of this insanity with someone like yourself. Folks should check out Hullabaloo is it Digby's blog at blogspot or .blogspot.com still?
.net. Digby'sblog.net.
Okay. Digby'sblog.net. Heather, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Sam. Take care.
As the death toll of Americans grows close to 70,000 people, the Trump administration has begun to take a victory lap, using creative accounting to justify what can only be seen as a total and complete failure. Here to discuss why the numbers just don't add up, Robert Mackey from The Intercept. So, Robert, we're talking midweek, more or less, and we are now in the United States hovering around 70,000 deaths. This is... already we have blown through the early models that were presented by Donald Trump. Let's talk a little bit about in your piece, you note that Donald Trump and the administration is sort of, it's got this sort of weird strategy in which they're dealing with American deaths. They are attempting to sort of belittle, I guess at first they were attempting to belittle 60,000 deaths. We have gone through that number now. But what? Just give us a sense of where we are in terms of deaths relative to other Western industrialized countries. And also the very, what I think is a bizarre way in which the president and the administration is dealing with it and presenting it.
Yes. This is at the end of last week, Trump, in one event, made this kind of weird boast about what he called our very, very strong death totals. And it caught people's attention because it seems like such a strange thing to say just as we passed at that stage 65,000 dead within just over a month, basically. And it turns out to be the case that when you look into it, he started saying something form of this over and over again recently, since about mid-April. And that was when his senior medical advisor, Dr. Deborah Birx, presented this chart at one of the briefings where she showed a selected number of countries, the relative mortality rate, that is the number of people dead per capita, basically. In her chart, it was per 100,000, it was deaths per 100,000 of population. And the point of this chart seemed to be, it was looking at the 10 worst affected countries in the world, and it seemed to be to minimize the deaths in the U.S. because the U.S. Per million people, you know, for the population per capita, it was relatively low in that list. It was seventh. There were six Western European countries that had more deaths per capita at that stage. And what's odd about that, it struck me when I watched it, I was trying to understand, why did they pick these countries? What about these countries seemed to be an apt comparison? And when you look into it, what's weird about it is that there was another European country on the chart, which is Germany, which had a death rate of essentially about 40% of the United States per capita. Germany's a, you know, a similarly industrialized democracy with a large population, quite densely populated. But people, you know, basically have much better chance of dying if you're in the United States than if you're in Germany. And so the strange thing about the chart was, and that what Trump's then been saying since then, is this idea that the U.S. is doing better than everybody else. And what it ignores is that there are, you know, dozens of countries that were not picked to be on this chart that have lower mortality rates than the United States. And so when you start looking at it, there's all kinds of strange things to it. I mean, there's a question about why Western European countries, it includes Britain, France, Spain, the Netherlands, Italy, Belgium, why they have done relatively worse per capita than the U.S. It's probably to do with the population density. Western Europe is much more densely populated than the United States. I mean, we, many of us who live in cities around the country think of the United States as a, you know, pretty urbanized, densely populated country. But for instance, 20% of the American population is rural, whereas Belgium's rural population is 2%. Right. So it's really comparing apples and oranges anyway. But it's such a bizarre idea to think, well, if we're doing better than, you know, Belgium, we're great. And Trump is even, he's taken this to an absurd extreme, as he tends to. When he was meeting Governor Phil Murphy of New Jersey the other day, he claimed that we were the world leader. Our mortality rate was the lowest in the world. We were the best in the world. And it's not, it's off by, there are dozens and dozens of countries that have a lower rate of death. And of course, the other one that, which people are familiar with, that he's completely ignoring, it wasn't on the chart, is South Korea, which has a mortality rate of where the U.S. mortality rate is about 20 people. It's just over 20 people per 100,000 now. The mortality rate in South Korea is under is 0.48. So the question, I guess, that has to be asked is, what is this bizarre idea that we're going to judge ourselves in sort of world rankings by only looking at the worst other countries and saying, well, we're better than them? Why shouldn't an advanced democracy like the United States, which is an incredible, you know, a challenging health insurance system, but an incredibly well-developed public health infrastructure, why can't we do as well as Germany? And why can't we do as well as South Korea? If we were at this, if people in the United States were being kept alive at the same rate as people in Germany, our death total now wouldn't be near 70,000. It would be just over 25,000. So this chart that Trump relies on and that, you know, they put a sort of a happy talk look at, it actually reveals that tens of thousands of Americans are dead because his federal government couldn't handle this crisis as well as the one in Berlin.
And I guess, you know, without knowing what the, and I don't know the death rates that happen in a typical March or April in Germany. So I don't know if those numbers in Germany include any type of significant increase, unexplained increase in deaths in April of 2020 versus April 2019, 2018, 2017, et cetera, et cetera. We know that exists in this country. So at the very least, when we say 70, 75,000 deaths, what we're really talking about is probably a significant number more than that. But in terms of apples to apples comparison, we're just not, we're not performing as well as Germany. And you ask the question, why? But I mean, Robert, we sort of know the answer why, don't we? I mean,
we do.
it's not like they we know what their agenda was in doing this, at least tactically. It's hard to know what it is strategically, right? Like tactically, Donald Trump just wants, and we don't know. I mean, it could be, and I guess I'd like your take on this, whether it is Donald Trump is saying to these people, figure out a way of minimizing the deaths, or they are just trying to placate him. And so they're figuring out a way of minimizing, I should say, the death count, right? As opposed to the actual number of deaths. I don't know what your sense is of that. And it probably doesn't matter in the long run. I mean, this is the administration is doing this. That's their tactic. What is their strategy here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it seems to be an entirely purely political strategy. It's to downplay the severity of what's happening around us, you know, to say, well, everybody else is doing worse than we are, so you're lucky that only this many people have died. And I mean, Trump, he's openly said that, you know, the initial projection without mitigation was that it could have been 1 to 2 million people dying over the course of this. And so, gee, if only 100,000 people die, I've done a great, great job. I mean, it's stunning. But then the question has to be asked, you know, it's not just we think of, you know, Germany and South Korea, advanced democracies, you know, a lot of testing. They've been able to get on top of things. But look, countries like Greece, Austria, Portugal, Canada have done much better jobs than we have, where their death rates are far, far lower. And so the question is, are we going to allow Trump and the administration to just try to put a positive spin on the terrible job they've done with this? But I think also, you know, Sam, it's not controversial at this stage to realize that early intensive widespread testing was key to how South Korea and Germany have dealt with this. And Germany, it's not like the same level of success. There's a lot of infections in Germany. But if you get sick in Germany, people are just not dying at anything like the rate that they're dying in the United States.
And that's, I mean, that could be a twofold issue. One being that they just have an infrastructure, a healthcare infrastructure that makes them have a population that is just literally more durable, I guess, in terms of in face of a virus. And they have a system that's more durable. They also the testing has also got a sort of a twofold impact, it seems to me. One is you're testing, right? So you're literally being able to isolate those people who have it. But you're also sort of signaling to the general population, hey, we got something that we are taking seriously here. Whereas the Trump administration not only did not roll out these things, but was literally until, I mean, arguably, you know, last week when Trump is, you know, texting out free Michigan or wherever it was, that he's been advocating don't take this seriously for months and months. And that's got to affect people's behavior in terms of the way they approach, you know, exposing themselves and whatnot.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's another part of this that another outrageous, insane thing that Trump said last week that didn't really get enough attention, I think, was that he tried to maintain, he was asked at one of these events now where they have like basically his supporters into the White House and then ask a few questions. The media gets to ask a few questions because he, you know, freaked out so much at the regular press conferences. But at one of these, he was asked by a reporter, well, look, you said in late February when there were 15 cases in the U.S. that it was going to be down close to zero within a few days. And now just in purely not the deaths, but in terms of numbers of cases, it's well over a million now. So why were you wrong about that? And he said, well, you know, a lot of the experts told me that. The experts were wrong. And what's incredible about that is that when you look back, I mean, it's, you know, it's like doing historical research from, you know, weeks ago. It's insane how they try to bury this stuff. I mean, if you look back, he said on February 26th, he tried to tell everyone it was no big deal. It was just like the flu. Don't worry about it. That's when he said we would be down to close to zero within a few days. The day before that, February 25th, the senior respiratory infection person at the CDC said that disruption to ordinary life was going to be severe, and she was already talking to her family and her kids about how they were going to deal with all this. And so that's where you see, you know, the president's not only his crazy predictions, but his modeling, this other part of this whole crazy thing where he won't wear a mask. And he makes it seem like it'd be embarrassing to wear a mask. You know, he said he doesn't want to sit behind the Oval Office desk talking to kings and, he mentioned dictators for some reason, and, you know, other leaders wearing a mask, that it wouldn't look right. And so then you see, like, in lots of parts of the country, people aren't doing it because they think it's embarrassing.
Right.
It's somehow not a sign of being macho enough. And I think,
right,
you know, anecdotally, I've seen more women wearing masks. It seems to be the case that somehow he's channeling some sort of macho denialism. But yes, these things have really deadly consequences in these circumstances. And of course, and these people don't just infect themselves, they infect everybody else. So it's like,
well,
you know,
exactly.
It's also Trump calls the herd mentality. He keeps referring to herd immunity as herd mentality. But herd mentality, unfortunately, is an issue that we have to deal with.
Yeah, just to reiterate, because I can't let a moment pass where I don't get to say this. Your mask protects me. My mask protects you. Unless people are walking around with an N95 or better mask, it's not a question of keeping the coronavirus out. It's a matter of keeping yours, because you may not be exhibiting symptoms, in, essentially, and instead of broadcasting it to everybody. But let me just go back to this strategy, because, I mean, I get the idea of getting up there and saying, you know, we're doing better than anybody else, and look at our rate of infection, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a problem with that strategy, and that is time and reality. Right now, the CDC this week, apparently, according to the New York Times, found a document that says they're anticipating in late May and by June, 3,000 deaths a day. The outfit in Washington that made the model that became everybody relied on and was subsequently, I think, you know, many people had criticism of it, have now more or less 2.5 times their assumption of where we would be in August. Right now, June 1st, you know, we're going to have, you know, like I say, maybe 200,000 deaths by that point, or 200,000 cases a day. I mean, I don't understand why they are out there. Talk about, I mean, let's put it this way. If you and I could have said to George Bush, hey, man, this whole mission accomplished thing, you may want to hold off on that, because the math shows that this is a little bit premature for that. Like, we don't have that kind of situation. Anybody who can do math can get to at least the idea that we're not done with deaths. I mean, if he's talking about herd immunity, he calls it herd mentality. Well, you can't get there unless you have 60 or 70% of the population infected. If 5% of the population's infected and we've had 75,000 deaths, I mean, people can do the math. You need to do 12 times that. We're talking about nearly 1 million people dying, assuming we're able to do it in a way that is controlled enough so that our medical services are not overrun. I mean, who in the White House thinks it's a good idea to be doing spiking the football when they're on the 10-yard line of their own goal?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, I'm looking at that chart now that Dr. Birx showed and Trump stood in front of, blocking partly. But, you know, it was only April 18th. It's May 4th now. At that time, the U.S. mortality rate was 11 per 100,000. Now it's over 20. Now it's up where the European countries were when they were boasting about being better than them 2.5 weeks later. So, yeah, I mean, I guess you know, they're trying to get through the hourly news cycles. It's not very strategic.
Yes, it's also rather detrimental to our ability to keep those numbers down, because if I don't know any better, I watch the president, I walk away going, we're doing great. Nothing to worry about here. I'm going to go outside. And because I'm a tough guy, I don't need to wear a mask because I'm not afraid of catching coronavirus, even though I don't realize that what I'm really doing is risking creating a risk for everybody else.
Absolutely. I mean, that's been an interesting thing of, you know, doing some historical research. I looked, you know, at Trump's, the other bizarre thing he's doing that I'm sure you've heard this. He's continually referring to the 1918 flu pandemic as something that happened in 1917.
Yeah.
He just last night said that for the 38th time in the last 2 months, uncorrected. But, you know, when you look back at 1918, not 1917, it's pretty striking that it was extremely common. There are a lot of masks. This country dealt with it then and just did what it had to do. And, you know, all those historical pictures, the police are wearing them, the people on the streets, families. It's just something that makes common sense. It's incredible that this is now more difficult to communicate to people than it was in 1918.
Well, because we have somebody out there who's like actively working against all the mitigation strategies. Have you come to any type of understanding as to why he keeps referring to the pandemic of 1918 as happening in 1917? I mean, it did last through 1918 into 1919. I mean, arguably into the early parts of 1920. But I mean, why yeah. would he say that it started in 1917?
It's very bizarre. I mean, I went through, you know, the White House, at least the people transcribing his remarks, at least honest about it. There's these 38 references to 1917. A few times, I think six times, he said 1917, 1918, as though that was the duration of it. So maybe somehow he thinks that's it. I mean, what he's actually thinking, I don't know. But we do have, it sounds like a small thing. It's kind of maddening, but it does raise questions about, obviously, his interest or ability to take in detail and history. But how is he surrounded by so many people who won't correct him that he keeps embarrassing himself by saying this over and over again? There's some, you know, there is a little thread that you pull out, and then you think, like, well, what is going on in there?
Right. Well, God knows. I mean, I guess maybe someday down the road, we'll find out just sort of like the hostage situation that the medical people were involved in there. But until that time, Robert Mackey, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Always a pleasure.
Robert Mackey writes about national and international news through the prism of social media for The Intercept. You can read his piece, "Through Creative Accounting, Trump Tries to Cast America's Death Toll as an Achievement," over at TheIntercept.com. This week, the Supreme Court made news by live streaming its first phone hearing as a result of COVID-19. But the real story was a couple of cases where oral arguments were being heard to determine whether religious employers can ignore the civil rights of their employees. Here to discuss, Supreme Court expert Scott Lemieux. So, Scott, let's just start with this. That we're going to hear, is this going to be the first one that we have the opportunity to sort of hear the moot court as it? Well, I guess not moot, to hear the oral arguments, I should say.
Well, in real time. So, you know, generally, you know, the oral arguments will generally go up within a day or two. You know, and so if you go to the OAA.com website, which we're now, you know, doing remote exams, so we're trying to having, you know, it's coming up a lot in plagiarism reports, but it is this really useful site. And for almost all major opinions that, you know, from recent decades, you could get not only the oral argument, but if the arguments were read in court, you know, if opinions were announced in court, that audio is there too. The difference is that for whatever reason, the Supreme Court has never offered audio real time. It's a big deal if it even offers audio the same day. My opinion is that's always been dumb. Like, I think that Supreme Court oral arguments should be televised. You know, I think this kind of shroud of mystery that surrounds the court is actually really bad for democracy. Dahlia Lithwick had a good piece in Slate today making that argument. So what was different about yesterday was just that the oral arguments, you could listen in real time, so that they were done virtually, but there was no tape delay. Reporters could just listen in real time. And that's important because, you know, and Lithwick made this point that there are very few seats for the general public at at Supreme Court hearings, and even fairly limited seats for media. So this was an opportunity for everybody to hear the arguments in real time, which really was, you know, and it worked fine, you know, went through order of seniority. So actually Justice Thomas asked, you know, more comfortable in that setting, actually asked more questions. You know, and there's always been this, you know, whatever, you know, obviously I don't agree with Thomas ideologically, but this idea that like he's dumb because he doesn't speak in oral arguments is really misguided. Like, you know, that's, you know, the problem with Thomas isn't that he's not smart. That's not the issue. You know, but I think it's just, you know, that legitimately that I think that honestly, these arguments are actually less likely to have grandstanding that basically, you know, justices actually have to ask questions. They can't just, it's harder for them to use oral arguments to basically argue with each other with the lawyers there being full. So I actually thought it worked quite well, but it was an opportunity to actually hear oral arguments in real time. I didn't actually listen in because of time zone differences. For me, the arguments happen at 7 a.m. So I'm only going to listen in if it's a really major case. And they deliberately chose kind of a minor case just to kind of work the kinks out. But it is the opportunity, you know, when, for example, the Supreme Court hears oral arguments in the Louisiana abortion case, or even tomorrow morning when they're hearing another religious freedom case, a contraception case, I may well wake up for that. But I think it's a good, you know, I think it's a great thing, honestly, that, you know, I think people should just be able to hear it, even when they go back to live arguments, if ever.
Who knows, you know, right. But.
Trump gets done with this, you know, that I still think that, you know, that they should go back to that. You know, that's something I'm discovering as a teacher, is that honestly having to do remote teaching has caused me to sort of rethink some things that, you know, why was I doing this ever? And I think that we're going to see this too, that I'm hoping the Supreme Court will just see there really was never any good reason not to have the arguments be heard live. Nothing, you know, all the parades of horribles that they expected aren't going to happen. And I'm hoping this will just be permanent, even if there's not video, that if at least people could just listen to the arguments as they're happening.
And let me ask you one more question about that, because, you know, of the process before we get into the two religious, I guess, rights cases that we heard that we heard yesterday, as you say, and the one that they're going to hear tomorrow in terms of abortion, all of these. But just one more process question. And to be clear, They're doing this from home, or are they in one location? Because, I mean, as someone who has been doing audio like this for a long time remotely, right, from the guests, there is a distinction between sitting in a room with somebody and getting nonverbal cues, you know, whether it's from the plaintiff or the defense or the other judges. And so tell us how they're doing that.
My understanding is that they're at home. I don't believe they're in a centralized location. I'm 99% sure about that. You know, just because I think that, you know, because I think the social distancing issues involved in, you know, even if you can keep everybody 6 feet apart, you know, you're still having to travel, you know, you still might have to be in proximity. So I believe that they're just from home. So it's just like we are right now, or anybody doing a Zoom meeting. You know, I believe the justices are just at home and they're doing it that way. And, you know, yeah, you're right that especially doing audio, there are things you miss, you know, that there might be little cues in that. You know, but I think that that's also, you know, a surmountable problem. You know, they could also just go to video. There's no reason they can't do that. You know, but I mean, certainly if, you know, I think the current net right now is still, you know, the fact that we can hear the arguments in real time. And again, there are advantages and disadvantages that, you know, not, you know, being home means that you can miss up on some subtle things, some cues. And I can imagine if you're actually making the arguments. And that's why another reason the Supreme Court chose to start with that is that the patent case is being argued by Lisa Blatt, who you may remember from her disingenuous praise for Brett Kavanaugh. But, you know, she is an extremely experienced and effective Supreme Court advocate. So, you know, she would be somebody who wouldn't be thrown off by that. Certainly, if you were arguing a case in the Supreme Court for the first time, not being able to see some of those cues can make it a little bit more difficult. But on the other hand, at least if yesterday's any indication, you know, it also seemed to be more orderly, less grandstanding in ways that could actually be easier. So, you know, I think that we should keep an eye on that. But I'm not sure that the trade-off won't actually be better for people making the arguments.
All right. Enough of that process stuff. I find it really fascinating. And it's just one more thing that I think, you know, this era, hopefully not as long as one would expect, but hopefully it won't be, but we'll see. But this era will create some fundamental changes in the way that we function in, you know, in terms of work and society and whatnot. But on to the substance of the cases that that were heard yesterday. Two cases. One was Hosanna Tabor versus the EEOC. The other is Our Lady of Guadalupe School versus Morrissey Berry and St. James versus Beale. I guess these were combined cases. What are the issues in these cases?
Right. Okay. So Hassan Tabor is a 2012 Supreme Court case. And this sort of created a ministerial exemption from anti-discrimination laws. So the idea here, so, you know, as you know, both the federal and state level, employers are forbidden from engaging in certain forms of discrimination. So under the Civil Rights Act, race and gender, and there's an outside chance that by June that will also apply to sexual orientation. We may that's a case we may be talking about later later this year. And also another law that's relevant here is the Americans with Disabilities Act. So essentially, under Hassan Tabor, ministers are not, those protections do not apply to ministers. And it should be said that although it's not an easy case precisely, but it was unanimous. And essentially, there is a reasonable argument here, which is that the deal the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, the Free Exercise Clause offers is essentially that, religious organizations are supposed to stay out of the affairs of state, but in exchange, the state is also supposed to stay out of the affairs of religion. And whenever I, if I'm invited to talk to a conservative student group or something about religious freedom, I always emphasize that point, that the First Amendment is not an anti-religious thing. The whole point was to stop entanglement either way, so that, basically religious groups should not have undue influence over the state, but by the same token, they have to be given some autonomy that, you don't want the state to sort of be in the position of making religious groups choose their leaders. So, if that opinion is interpreted narrowly, I don't necessarily have a problem with it. What the issue with Our Lady of Guadalupe is that these religious schools are asking for ministerial exemptions for people they classify as secular workers. So these are just ordinary teachers. In one case, a teacher who's passed away and their state is suing, who just might teach a couple of hours of religion a week, but they don't have theology degrees. They don't lead religious institutions. They're just fairly ordinary teachers who just do some religious instruction. Essentially, if those teachers are classified as ministers, then that would, effectively allow schools to, avoid civil rights acts almost entirely. That essentially their employees would have almost no protections at all, because anybody who did any religious instruction could essentially be defined as a minister and be exempt from civil rights law. And that, to me, would be pushing things in a much broader direction.
I mean, theoretically, right? If I have a Catholic hospital and my doctors, I tell my doctors, make sure you bless the room when you go in or something,
right?
I mean, then we could just start saying that all the personnel that work in the hospital are sort of, anti-discrimination laws are suspended for everybody who works at the hospital.
Yeah, it's, And of course, the genesis of this was a concurrence written in Hassan Tabor by Justice Alito, basically inviting litigants to push it further. So, there was a classic case where Chief Justice Roberts was able to get unanimity by writing a very narrow opinion. But Alito basically says, let's open the door, wider with these issues that haven't settled. But yeah, I think to push that would be really dangerous. And I think it was Ian Millhiser at Vox, but I know somebody actually, found links to, essentially how religious institutions could basically game these tests and easily classify people as religious employees. So certainly what I think the court should do here is really, I would not overrule Hassan Tabor, but I would say, this only applies to top religious leadership. If people have a primarily secular function, then they're subject to anti-discrimination laws, and I don't think that would create an excessive entanglement with religion. Then again, I think that there can be some warning, that the government will have to show that an anti-discrimination, or the plaintiff would have to show that an anti-discrimination lawsuit is sound based on the merits, that there's no religious animus creeping in or anything like that. There are safeguards. But, this idea that you have to create incredibly broad exemptions to civil rights statutes to avoid violating the Establishment Clause, I think is silly. I mean, I think that religious leadership is a different issue. I think that that's fair. You really want to avoid pretextual, I'm fine with that. But once you start, making that apply to ordinary employees, I think that would be down really far down a slippery slope. But I have to say that it would not be shocking if the Supreme Court, in fact, went in that direction.
I want to get to that in a minute because, I mean, I feel like there is a real sense, a palpable sense of it's payback time. You know, we got you elected, Donald Trump. We gave you these opportunity to fill these two seats. And now it's payback time. The religious right is coming back and using these religious exemptions as a way of really undercutting and broadening the and rolling back, really, is what it is, the protections that we have in terms of discrimination, among other things as well. Let me. So how would you, if you were to narrow Hosanna Tabor and make it or clarify and edit, you know, I guess build upon the footprint that was laid there, how would you make the determination as to what was a primarily secular job? I mean, it seems to me it's relatively easy, but I don't know, maybe it's too broad thinking about it this way. But if I'm a company and I have a job that you are basically doing for a church or for a religious school or hospital, then you're a secular worker, right? Like there is no minister in a company. There is no minister in a restaurant, but there are managers, there are accountants, there are, you know, people who are, you know, doing labor. I mean, so is that how you would set the test, or is that just something that like somebody would come up with that?
Yeah, and I think that's what the plaintiffs are arguing here is, you know, that you should first of all start with formal titles. So what Alito is asking for is essentially that, you know, anybody involved with kind of religious decision making, you know, they're basically, it doesn't really matter what the hierarchy is, if you're involved. So like something like just religious instruction would be enough. Whereas, you know, what the plaintiffs are saying here is the fact that they're classified as teachers and not ministers actually is significant. Now, that can't be dispositive just because, you know, there's subjects, you know, if you're dealing with the Roman Catholic Church, you know, it's pretty obvious who's in the hierarchy and who isn't. But not all religions are structured that way. So for religions that don't have those kinds of clear lines of authority or whatever, you know, there may be some edge cases where you have to look a little bit beyond the formalities, and kind of look at what somebody's day-to-day job is. But that's the way I would do it. You know, first of all, start with how are these people being classified? And you also have to watch for, you know, that you have to create some kind of language saying that, you know, you can't get around that by just classifying everybody as a minister. You know, that has to be somebody who's primary job is leading religious services or, setting the tone or supervising many other, employees, something like that. So I think that you start with, you know, titles and really basic job descriptions. And then, yeah, there's going to be some marginal cases, you know, especially if you're dealing with a religious organization that has some kind of unusual non-hierarchical approach or something. But to me, you can't let the fact that, you know, that every constitutional law question always has some edge cases. You can't resolve everything. But to me, that's where I would start. But basically, I wouldn't do it the other way. Just kind of preemptively surrender and just say whoever the religious organization says has ministerial responsibilities has ministerial responsibilities. And that's really what Alito wants, is just almost unlimited deference to what the religious institutions say. But that's basically allowing, you know, that's the whole danger that Scalia identified in free exercise cases, that you're basically allowing, you know, organizations that perform secular functions to declare themselves exempt from civil rights laws by just calling everybody a religious employee. And that's obviously really problematic, and especially once you start to get to this idea that corporations can have religious identity, then you're really going, which we might get to, but even just confined to actually religious organizations, I think that's pretty disturbing. And I think that we should be, and again, I think that Hosanna Tabor is fine. I'm not saying that there's no legitimate clash between religious freedom and civil rights acts at all, but I certainly do think that in a secular society, civil rights should be in the preferred position, that any carve-outs to civil rights should be the exception, not the rule, and we should err on the side of not giving the exemption.
Let's pivot to we're recording this on Tuesday, and so what is the argument that we're going to hear tomorrow, another religious freedom case. I mean, it's not just me, right? There's a lot of these coming up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think I think you made a great point in terms of, you know, the sort of payback that there's quite a lot of evidence that it was the Supreme Court and that Supreme Court vacancy that sort of kept evangelicals in line, you know, that sort of all the evangelicals who voted for Cruz rather than Trump. One thing that was able to persuade them to get to the polls, even after the Access Hollywood tape, even after everything, was that vacancy. There's a whole other argument about why liberals do not have the same urgency, and I suspect that that's changing with the Kavanaugh confirmation, but of course it's kind of closing the barn after the horse is three counties over. But definitely, you know, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch in particular, you know, have, you know, a very Alito-like view of religious freedom, which is actually quite different than Scalia and Kennedy, quite a bit more conservative. So, you know, one thing is that my guess is that the Roberts Court is probably not going to be super enthusiastic about overruling your Bergfeld decision, the same-sex marriage decision. First of all, because I think that would produce a very visible backlash. And secondly, it just doesn't seem to be a big project for the conservative movement as a whole. You know, somewhat surprisingly, you know, you don't get the sense that evangelical groups are really anxious, you know, that considering how much how strongly they're imposed beforehand, you know, there doesn't seem to be, you know, it doesn't seem to be a top priority. And, you know, so one would think that Roberts doesn't really want to go there. If the personnel of the court changes, that could be different. But where I do think you're going to see blowback against LGBT rights is going to be in these cases, you know, basically saying that civil rights laws don't apply or that, you know, essentially, you know, employers can declare themselves religious and therefore get out of things like providing contraceptive benefits that federal even if federal regulations require them to be given.
And is that the issue tomorrow?
Yes. So, and this is a little bit complicated. So many of your listeners will remember the Hobby Lobby case in which the Supreme Court said that a corporation, at least if it wasn't publicly held, could declare itself to have religious convictions and therefore cannot be substantially burdened under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And the court ruled, therefore, that Hobby Lobby did not have to provide contraceptives as part of the health coverage it gave its employers. Even though that had been required by the Obama administration. Now, the twist with these cases is that the Trump, you know, one of the many bad things that happens when a Republican administration takes over is that the Trump administration rolled back those regulations and essentially said that if a business had any religious or moral objection to contraceptives, they didn't have to provide it. So what's interesting is that the Trump administration is arguing that under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, this broad exemption would have to be given even if the regulation was modified. So even if, you know, President Biden or President Inslee or whoever, you know, comes in office in 2021 and goes back to the old regulation, what the Trump administration is urging the court to do is to say that there has to be a religious exemption that's very broad, you know, even if contraception is again required under the old standard. So that's something that would be a ruling that the next Democratic administration couldn't even change.
Right.
One thing, and we'll have to hear for oral arguments tomorrow, my understanding is that the Trump administration will have a very good chance of winning on the religious exemption. With respect to the moral exemption, that might be a little bit trickier. You know, so that it could be that the Trump administration is allowed to make that change in a regulatory manner. That would be a real stretch. And I suspect that you might get one of those Roberts kind of splitting the baby kind of superficially moderate opinions that grants a permanent religious exemption, but not a moral exemption, even though practically the difference, you know, I mean, I guess there may be people with a secular moral objection to contraception, you know, like a men's rights organization, I don't know, Colette, I don't know, Sonia Sacker.
Right, but, right.
You
right.
know, practically almost all, you know, attempts to get a contraceptive exemption are going to be religious or can be framed as being religious. So it probably doesn't, you know, so it's one of the, it might, if so, it'd be one of those opinions that's actually not really as moderate as it looks like. But that's, you know, but it'll be interesting to see the oral argument, because that's the big thing, is that it's a classic case where the court can rule narrowly or can rule broadly. So first of all, it has to decide if the Trump administration did this in a way that comports with, you know, basic administrative procedure. And if it does, it can sort of rule narrowly and say, you know, yeah, this, you know, as of now, you have a religious or moral exemption, but, you know, the next Democratic administration can change that back. Or they can interpret the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and say, nope, in fact, the next Democratic administration wanted to change, this broad exemption is necessary. Now, of course, this isn't based on the First Amendment. So another thing a Democratic Congress could do would be to modify the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But that's just a tougher lift, sort of being perceived as, attacking religious freedom, even if it's not fair. Is going to be a tougher lift. Plus, you know, the next unified Democratic government really is going to have a lot of things on its plate.
Yeah.
And that's part of it, is that, you know, everything that the Supreme Court can make the Congress clean up is just one thing. You know, there's only so many fights you can have, only so many things on your agenda. So, the next Democratic government is just going to, face a lot of tough choices about what do you clean up from what the Roberts Court has done. You know, what new items can you prepare? You know, it's going to be really tricky. So that's another thing where, you know, even if Congress theoretically can change it, it's a lot harder in practice than it is in theory sometimes.
Scott Lemieux, thank you so much for catching us up on this. I really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Sam. Take care and hang in there, and we'll talk to you soon.
Scott Lemieux is a lecturer in political science at the University of Washington, specializing in constitutional law, the Supreme Court, and American Political Institutions and Development. He's the co-author of the runaway bestseller, Judicial Review in Contemporary Democratic Theory, Power, Domination, and the Courts. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Special thank you to all our free podcast subscribers that have converted into members this week. Really appreciate your joining up and supporting the show. I cannot thank you enough. And if you are listening to the free podcast, consider becoming a member of the full show over at rofpodcast.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. Go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm every day at noon for the live stream, or later as a podcast. Long form interviews, breakdowns of the news, mocking right wingers. We got the whole shebang over there. My name is Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.